Spring fans, welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of the pod, where today we get to have a discussion with the one, the only, the inimitable, the amazing Madhura Bhave, a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech, as it so eloquently says on her Twitter profile. Madhura is a core member of the Spring Boot engineering team. She is, of course, responsible for things like the revised security infrastructure in Spring Boot 2.0. If you've worked with the actuator, you've no doubt worked with stuff that she's working on. She's just doing all sorts of really cool stuff. And she came to the Spring R&D group from the sort of main of the larger Pivotal R&D group. In particular, she was working on Cloud Foundry, right? So she's a test-driven sort of Pivotal engineer, and she brought that amazing skill and all that and that amazing work ethic to the Spring team. And she has, you know, going beyond just the R&D stuff, where she's one of the most vital members of our team. She's also, you know, recently, for example, she did this really great thing where she surfaced a whole bunch of GitHub issues that would be ideal for contributions for beginners, and that in turn inspired a whole discussion. So I'm really glad to be able to have had the chance to talk with her. We recorded this interview in August of 2018, and I hope you enjoy this interview. Hi, Madhura.
Hi, Josh. How's it going?
Thanks for joining me. It's good. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I'm not in the same place as you are, even though nominally.
Technically, you do have a house here.
Technically. But yeah. My point is, I was thinking this might be the one podcast I got to record in person, and somehow I managed to bungle that up. So thank you for being so accommodating of the time zone weirdness.
No problem.
What did I interrupt? I know it's right in the middle of the day as we record this on a Sunday, on a sunny day in the summer in 2018. Mm-hmm. Tell the audience, what's your name and what do you do?
So my name is Madhura Bhave, and I'm a developer on the Spring Boot team. I've been on the Spring Boot team for about 2 years now.
Wow.
Can't believe it's been two years already. But
me either.
I joined in, I think, around October 2016. And
that's officially on the Spring Boot team, though. But you were actually working with Spring for a long time before that.
So, I mean, I was working with Pivotal for a long time before that. I joined Pivotal in 2013, so that's been 5 years there.
Yeah. And weren't you on the security side of things?
Yeah, so I joined Pivotal and I was working on Cloud Foundry. So actually, even before joining the UAA team, which is the security component of Cloud Foundry,
based on Spring Security OAuth.
Correct, but based on Spring Security OAuth. I worked for a little bit on Apps Manager. And I'll tell you how that's relevant in a bit, because when I joined the Spring Boot team, there was some integration between the Spring Boot team and Apps Manager and the UAA. So those were actually three of the projects that I happened to have worked on.
Oh, interesting. So that's your past kind of, you're able to turn your past experiences into better integrations for Spring developers on the platform these days.
Yeah. So, in Spring Boot 1.5, they wanted to add actuator integration into the Apps Manager dashboard. So you could see your app's health, per instance health, and the info for your app, etc. And obviously, because it's part of the platform, it needed to be authorized and authenticated by the UAA. So that's where the UAA component, the integration, came in. And that was actually the first bit that I worked on when I joined Spring Boot. So it was pretty cool that I could just transition slowly from UAA onto Spring Boot, but still, you know, communicate with the UAA.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I know we had an opening, and it was sort of, we needed an opening just generically for somebody to help make Spring Boot even more awesome. And then the fact that we had these sort of use cases that landed right then and there, that's really cool, you know?
Yeah, I guess I happened to be at the right place at the right time, so I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. You've been one of those rock stars that is always doing something big and feature and user facing, right? And I think that's nice.
it's very easy for us on the Spring team to get lost in the framework, you know, the stuff behind the scenes, you know, and to be able to connect that with features in production. That's a big deal. All right. So you've been with Pivotal since 2015. AppsMinter, that's not in Spring, right? Is that in Rails?
That's not in Spring. That was written in Rails, and now it's a single page JavaScript app, I think.
Cool.
That's changed since I moved.
Was that Angular or React or?
React, I believe.
Okay, that's interesting. Very cool. So, and when we say Apps Manager, we're talking about the wetware friendly user interface for Cloud Foundry that ships with Pivotal's distribution of Cloud Foundry called PCF, right?
Yep, exactly. So it's the nice little dashboard where you see your applications and the spaces and the orgs that the app is running in. And you can see your permissions and roles as a user.
And and you can provision new services, deploy. You can't deploy apps, but you can manage them there. You can start them, stop them, whatever.
Mm-hmm. You can bind services, unbind.
Right. And you can also, it's sort of a single pane of glass, right? You can see the state of all your different services, the apps and their instances, and their health and so on.
So that was the nice thing with the Actuator integration, that if you happen to have multiple instances of the application running, you can see the health per instance. It's not just the health of your app, but it's the health per instance that you can see.
Right, which is super cool. So that Actuator integration is new. Relatively. I mean, I think of it as being new, but we're at 2.0 now, 2.04.
Yeah, so it was added in 1.5.
Right.
And we just released, well, I wouldn't say just, we released 2.0 March of 2018.
Yeah, that's a big deal. But I still think of those actuator, was it 1.5 or 1.4?
The actuator integration with the apps manager was 1.5.
Okay.
But actuators have been there before.
Oh, sure.
Day
zero. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the actuator integration, it seems so obvious, and yet I don't see a lot of other technologies taking advantage of this. Our Spring Boot apps, if they're used, they can tell the platform about themselves. They can speak up and volunteer information through these standardized endpoints, you know, these actuator endpoints. So I
think even with like the whole Kubernetes thing and stuff, they have the liveliness probe, the readiness probe. Yep. So they can actually use the health and info endpoint from the app to determine if an app needs to be restarted.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, because the actuator endpoint speaks status codes, right? Your platform mm-hmm. doesn't yep. need to know about the JSON that's emitted. They can just look at the HTTP 200 versus 500, whatever, that the actuator health input
right.
gives. But we go a step further. You can actually reconfigure logs from within Apps Manager, for example.
So the loggers endpoint was added in 1.5. And that not only gives you information about the loggers in your application, but you can actually change the loggers at runtime. So that's great, right?
Super
and
cool.
You can do that from Apps Manager with just like, you can see it in the nice UI. Click on the level that you want to configure a specific logger to, and there you go.
Nice.
You can change from debug to info or whatever.
And you help build that integration. Obviously, you have an understanding of Apps Manager and Spring Boot. You know, you were able to speak to both sides competently.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? I mean, you came from the Pivotal Labs style of engineering, right? You had presumably at that point been very confident in testing everything first and so on. Whereas with Spring, you know, the results are usually fine, but I think it's fair to say most of us don't write the tests first or not necessarily. How was that? I mean, was there a jump or?
So it was a jump. So when I was on Cloud Foundry, I used to obviously pair program from 9 to 6 mm-hmm. every single day, Monday to Friday. And as you know, the Spring team is quite distributed.
Yes.
So pair programming would be almost impossible
right.
with the different time zones and stuff. And just the way they work, the distributed nature of the Spring team and the Spring community has worked great so far.
Mm-hmm.
But when I moved, I was a little scared initially because for the ramp up period, since this was a totally new, it felt like a new job, even though I was in the same company, I was like, oh, this is so different. But the great thing was that the lead of the Spring Boot project, Phil Webb, mm-hmm. he's in San Francisco too. So he was kind enough to pair with me for the initial first few weeks.
Lucky him. I'm sure he learned a lot.
Well, I definitely learned a lot. Wow. So, yeah, I think my ramp up was great because I was able to work with Phil and not have to worry about waiting to get a response if I was stuck on something.
That's awesome. So the team, so the team itself is, you're set in PST in San Francisco. Phil is in San Francisco, but isn't he, I think he took the holiday off for the summer. Or he's in.
I think he's back.
Oh, he's back already. Oh, good.
Well, next week
we should all hang out before spring one. But anyway, he's there, and then we've got Andy over in the UK, Southampton. You got Stefan in Belgium. You've got who else?
Brian's in France.
Brian Cozell's in France, right? So you've got a lot of people in UK, or you know, GMT plus or minus eight, and then GMT, and then GMT minus one. Or plus one. No, GMT plus one. We're minus eight, right? PST?
Yeah, we're minus.
Yeah, so Andy's in the UK. That's just GMT zero, you know, and then Stefan.
And then Belgium is GMT plus one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So by the time you roll into work, half the team's already just called it quits for the day, basically.
They're still there. They're hanging. Yeah, I mean, I think they work pretty late, or maybe they come back online or something.
Yeah, no doubt.
I know
Jürgen does, for example. I know he'll chime in and work, you know, let's say 3/4 of a day in the morning, his time, and then after dinner, make sure to be available as well.
Yeah, I think that's what the Spring Boot folks do too. So they're pretty much around until noon my time,
right. Which is nice of them. That's a hard slog. So yeah, it makes the pair programming doesn't get to happen as easily. But the fact that they're so dedicated to making it work and being a part of the team.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've never had an issue with getting a response back or being stuck for the longest time.
Really, really. That's one of the things I love about this team is it's not what we're trying to do here is to build stuff across the divide of the expanse of the planet and build the best thing we can with the best people. And we don't let little things like physical geocality get in the way. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely not. And coming back to what you were saying about testing.
Yeah.
So obviously on Cloud Foundry, when I was pair programming, we did do TDD. So it was always test first, unless we were spiking on a feature.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually carried that on Spring Boot. I always write my tests first, unless there's like this feature and I don't know what it's going to look like. I just spike it. But then once I start implementing it again, I write the tests first. So it's just something that I'm used to and that works well. So I've continued the TDD pattern.
So yeah, I've heard that once bitten with test-driven development, it's hard to go back. I know that Phil. So one thing, I when we started Spring Boot, 2013, in 2014, Brian Dussault asked me to go visit a number of the Pivotal Labs offices worldwide. You know, I just started visiting offices and going there and pair programming with him for a week at a time. So I went to New York and Chicago and a bunch of these other organizations. And my job was just to help them because, you know, as you know, there's a lot of really competent, really, really careful, really brilliant people working in labs. But at the time they were doing, for example, Rails, right? Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, it might even still be true, there was no mandate that they had to use anything in Spring, right? Spring, it had to be worth using on its own. It wasn't just that. There's a mandate from on high saying you must use Spring for all consulting, you know?
Yeah, no, there wasn't. In fact, most of the offices were Rails heavy.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole point for me was to go to these offices and to sort of pair program with them. And I found that to help spread through osmosis some of what Spring Boot can do. You know, we had really, really bright people coming from Rails now spinning up on Spring Boot. I found that, you know, I find if you take people who are disciplined, who care about test-driven development, who care about, working communicatively, if you find people that have the kind of programmers' hygiene that people in labs have, that it makes it pretty easy for them to spin up on something like Spring Boot because they know what the best practices are. And in fact, in a lot of cases, not a lot of cases, in some cases, there are things that just weren't quite up to spec. It weren't up to snuff with respect to what they were used to from the Rails community because they had a much stronger testing ethos over there. Whereas in the enterprise Java, you know, that's fairly while TDD and you know JUnit and all this stuff started in the Java space, the zealotry for it, the religiousness about it, the need to do it.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So I guess you know this, but Phil Webb also paired or worked with some labs teams in maybe Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where a lot of the testing improvements that were made in Spring Boot 1.4 came from. Slices and things like that,
yeah,
so the slicing and I don't know, there was some other cool feature testing features added in 1.4. And those were actually enhancements that could be added, that could be seen when we were working on labs projects. And because of their rigorous TDD practices, that surfaced. So
I think it's really come out nicely. I think there's probably still some gaps. I mean, but on the whole, I've seen the Spring team. We've always wanted Spring to be the most natural thing for people who cared about testing, obviously. So you were ignorant of the particular runtime. You could test it in isolation. You didn't need an EGB server to do to business logic test your business services. But still, you know, it wasn't nearly as strong as some of these other communities had. And so I think a lot of that work that Phil's done, and I'm sure others have well, Sam Brennan, of course, he's done a lot of work. I think a lot of that work has been really, really nice. And I think the Spring team has in recent years really gone out of its way to make testing a full sort of fully featured thing. So I look at what Marcin Grzeszak is doing around Spring Cloud Contract and, you know, Spring Cloud Pipelines and all that. And just, it's so satisfying to see all this come together finally.
Yes.
So are there things that you are used to from, for example, Apps Manager and testing and so on that were a little bit difficult to sort of overcome in Spring that didn't have a direct equivalent?
No, because you mean in the Spring tools available itself or in the team structure or the way we wrote our tests?
Everything. I mean, just choice of tools, technologies, practices. What were some of the things that we needed to do better or that have gotten better since you joined? I'm always curious about this because you come from, you know, you're fresh off of another very widely used, very rich ecosystem.
Got it. So we did. So like I said, not everybody on the Spring team writes tests first, but the great thing about it is, because we work in our own ways, we can do what suits us best. So I still write my tests first and I'm still using TDD. And the slices have been there since I joined. So that was great. I didn't have to start up the context every time for a unit test or, you know, slow the test down unnecessarily. One of the things that's been great is obviously Spring Boot has a lot of auto configuration, right? And when we add more auto configuration, so for example, I'm adding some OAuth auto configuration at the moment that's being added as part of Spring Security 5 and 5.1.
Is that the resource server stuff?
Yeah, so it's the resource server. And for the client side, there's the authorization code support that's added.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
We'll come back. So because Spring Boot integrates all these different projects and provides auto-configuration for them, writing tests for auto-configuration is obviously equally important to make sure that all your conditionals on classes and conditionals on beans work as you expect them to work. So in Spring Boot 2, we added this helper class for testing auto-configuration specifically. So it's like this application context runner with nice assertions and a filtered class loader. So if you're trying to test a conditional on a class on an auto-configuration, you can actually start it up with a filtered class loader and assert that, hey, if this class is missing, this bean doesn't kick in or whatever.
Oh, that's very cool.
So,
I think
writing auto configuration tests has been a breeze since then.
Nice. And that you actually have the ability to, yeah, you said you mentioned the filter class loader. You can actually, because a problem we had before was I could set properties. I could do the property nvutils or whatever and set properties. I could do all sorts of things, but I couldn't selectively disable classes on the class path, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you could, but it was just harder. Right. And now it's just easier with this one single utility class.
That's awesome.
And plus it has nice assertions like the context does not have been or has been, or the context started up with this failure. So it's just a nice handy way to test your auto configuration classes.
And there was a blog about all this, it seems to me, just in the last 6 months.
Yeah, I think I published a blog about this.
Okay, cool. So people should look for that. That's a good, because I think we're now down the road with Spring Boot here. We're no longer trying to get people just to start building apps with it. It's starting to become something that they want to, the product of which we want to share with other parts of the organization. So people are auto configuring stuff. They're creating reusable bits and starters and so on. So that having good best practices around that documented and available for people to consume is as valuable now as starting a new project used to be with Spring Boot, you know?
Yep.
And testing that, of course, is a big deal. Okay, well, that's cool. So can we go back to that security thing? Because that, I think, is super interesting. You, because you have your experience with UAA, you've sort of acted as the liaison between the Spring Boot team and the Spring Security efforts and so on. So you just mentioned some of the big features coming in Spring Security 5, which is the preliminary OAuth login support that came in Spring Security 5, and then 5.1, we've got the new resource server. I know. Are you working with Josh Cummings on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Josh Cummings.
How's he doing?
Oh, he's great. Yeah. I just spoke to him this morning about an issue that we were discussing on GitHub.
Hard to believe it. He's new. I keep thinking of you as being fairly new to the Spring team itself, and
I know. I think I'm old.
Yeah,
now,
you are. So. It's awesome. Okay,
So going back to the OAuth thing. So before Spring Boot 2, a lot of the OAuth code was sort of spread around between Spring Boot and Spring Security OAuth. Mm-hmm. And when Spring Security 5 came about, they wanted to fold the Spring Security OAuth 2 project into Spring Security itself. And so we could then just use Spring Security 5 and provide auto configuration for whatever Spring Security supported. So we moved all of the OAuth code that was dispersed around in Spring Boot into the separate jar. So let's say you're using a 1.5 Spring Boot app, mm-hmm, with OAuth support, and you migrate to Spring Boot 2. Because Spring Security 5 hadn't yet added support for the resource server stuff, you could use this other extra jar if you wanted to continue using the resource server support from Spring Boot 1.5. Yeah, it was like bridge. But the cool thing is in Spring Boot 5.1, which is what we're going to add in Spring Security 5.1, which is what's going to be in Spring Boot 2.1, there is support for the resource server, which is what Josh Cummings has been adding.
So for the audience here, OAuth, what is it? And for listeners, we also did an interview with Sri Tumidi, who spoke a little bit about this. But for our listeners on this one, what is OAuth, and then what does it mean to talk about the client versus the resource server?
Right. So OAuth is basically this specification for authorization. And I think now it's at OAuth 2.0. And OAuth 2.0 has these four concepts. There's a resource owner, which is the user. So like you, let's say, mm-hmm, you are trying to sign into some application, let's say some music application, right? And when you want to access your own music, you want to log in through something, let's say like Facebook.
Right.
So Facebook in this case would be the authorization server. So your music app is not going to collect your credentials, but instead it's going to redirect you to Facebook. So Facebook is the authorization server. And when you log into Facebook, Facebook will redirect with a token or whatever they redirect with to the music application. And the music application is the thing that owns your resources. So it could be your albums or your playlists and stuff. And it looks at the token that it receives from Facebook and it says, okay, hey, this is Josh. And he has access to so-and-so albums, so-and-so playlists. So I'm going to show it to him. So in this case, the resource server, which is the music app, it validates the token from the authorization server, which is Facebook, and shows it to the resource owner, which is you.
I see. Okay. So the resource server basically is an API that that the user would, like, if I wanted to create an API, that would be the thing I expose to the world, and the authorization server could be co-located with the resource server, but it, like for example, Facebook is separate endpoint, and so it could be a separate thing as well. And the authorization server would be shared across all accesses to these resources.
I guess the resource server, it could be an API. Yeah, in this example, you could have another thing in there, which is an OAuth client. Mm-hmm. And then that talks to this the music API, which would actually own your resources.
Interesting. That's cool. Okay, and so the resource server support now in Spring. So we had OAuth login. That means in Spring Security 5, we could already say here and delegate authentication to Facebook, and then get back an OAuth token, and then bear that, use that in place of an actual Spring Security based identity provider. Basically, we're asking Facebook or something else that supports this OAuth process to give us.
Yeah. So in the OAuth 2 login that was in Spring Boot, added in Spring Boot 2 or Spring Security 5, that was more like an OpenID Connect login. So OpenID Connect sort of sits on top of OAuth. And it gives you like user information and stuff. So the OAuth2 login in Spring Boot 2 was the OpenID Connect related.
And so now we have the ability to say, I have an API and I want to reject requests to this API that are not authenticated via something like OAuth login or something.
Yeah. So that would be the resource server, the API that does
that. Oh, that's so cool. Okay. And so that's going to be in Spring Security 5 itself, not Spring Security OAuth. That Spring Security OAuth is hopefully becoming less and less relevant and eventually gone.
So Spring Security 5.1 for resource server.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, that support now in Spring Security 5 is, you know, being honest, it's not that hard to use directly. But in Spring Boot, you've done quite a bit to make Spring Security, working with Spring Security from Spring Boot, even more pleasant. I think Rob Winch and his team have done an amazing job of reducing it down to its bare minimum these days, especially as of later Spring Security 4 and 5.0 releases. But I noticed that in Spring Boot 2.0, you completely revamped the auto configuration for security in general in Spring Boot, right?
Yeah, so with security, it's really hard to guess what a user wants, right? Like you always want to assume the most secure option. So instead of trying to guess what the user wants to secure and what the user doesn't want to secure, we went with the most secure option, which is just secure everything. So if you have Spring Security on your class path in Spring Boot 2, you get this default security configuration. So we just rely on Spring Security's content negotiation for the form login and HTTP basic stuff. And we give you one default user with a generated password that you need to. So anything you access out of the box is secured.
Right.
So your application is secured, your actuators are secured in the same way. Now, if you want to start adding custom security, we say that, okay, hey, you know what you're doing. And at this point, you've sort of taken the control into your own hands. And we're not going to try and mess with your custom security configuration. Because a lot of times, like all these things with these web security configurator adapters and stuff, there can be ordering issues if there are multiple. So let's say you started adding your own custom security configurator adapter, and we still stuck ours in, there could have been ordering issues, which used to happen in 1.5. So we decided to change that in 2.0, and as soon as the user starts configuring their own security, we just back off our auto configuration completely.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. So now it's very simple to wrest control of the security. Now, is you didn't leave, like, one of the things that was nice about the existing support from before was that you'd have the Spring Security auto configuration for Spring for the rest of the application, and then you'd have it for the actuator. Now, I still want to be able to express in my new app that I can lock down the actuator without having to do some custom, hopefully this is the right configuration kind of thing. So I noticed that, what's the right way for users to do that? What if they still want to be able to say match these actuator endpoints?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so because you can configure the context path for your actuators, you don't want to have to copy paste that in your security configuration. So we have this nice convenience class called endpoint request. And if you do endpoint request dot, let's say, to any endpoint, it'll give you a request matcher, security request matcher for all the actuator endpoints, because it knows about what your actuator's context path is. So you can use the endpoint request in your custom security configuration to conveniently secure actuators.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the actuator, you can still very easily with one line lock down your actuator endpoints. You're not left by yourself anymore, I guess. That's what I'm just trying to get to. That's really cool.
Yeah, because we took away a lot of the security configuration and the flags that people were used to in 1.5, there were these management.secure.something flags. So I don't remember all of them, but they were a bunch of flags. So because we took those away in order to simplify things, we wanted to make adding custom security as easy as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's so cool. Okay, so so that was in this Spring Security, that was building on Spring Security 5 in Spring Boot 2.0. Now with the fundamentals in place, now the new stuff is all Spring Security and the OAuth integration. Mm-hmm. That's so cool. That came about really quickly too. I don't think people appreciate just how quickly all this has happened. Spring Security 5 came out towards the end of last year, right? It very shortly after Spring 5.
Yeah.
So the fact that we're already able to add, we went from basic OAuth client OIDC support to the resource server. That's a big feature, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know a lot of people actually, they use the resource server support, because of which we created that separate jar. So I think it's good if they're able to remove that jar instead of this out of the box support from Spring Security 5.1.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so cool. And it's cleaner. I mean, the old Spring Security OAuth was nice, but it was showing it's showing its age, you know. OIDC wasn't quite as natural as it could be. The JOT claims and things like the
it's much easier to configure now. I think the security team has done a great job.
Likewise, and the Spring Boot team, that's what I'm saying. All this stuff has been, the fact that we've gone from Spring Framework 5 to having this really, really be supported out of the box nicely is, I think, a big deal. Now, what is the thing you're going to work on now? What is the thing, what's the big thing coming? I mean, I know we're ramping up for Spring Boot 2.1 with an RC that just dropped.
What is the next thing? Yeah. No, we just dropped the second milestone. I think we might do a third.
Yeah, well, good. I mean, but that's impressive. That's 2.1 already.
It is 2.1 already. You know, I don't know. So, okay, here's the thing. So the Spring Boot team is working as a team now on Spring Initializer 2. Mm-hmm. So we're all trying to, we haven't gotten there as much yet, but we do want to spend a considerable amount of our time on Spring Initializer. Because as you know, Spring Initializer is it the best place on the internet? I don't know. Or is it
second
the second
best place?
What do you say?
After production.
Is it the second? Okay. So it's the second best place on the internet. So clearly we could use more hands on it.
Yeah.
And I'm actually planning to spend spend some time improving maybe the user experience on Spring Initializer. We have some issues on GitHub around usability, so maybe look at some of those.
Awesome. Oh, that's so cool. So is if people want to, if they have feedback, I suppose GitHub is the right place to put those, and I'm sure that'll get to you one way or another. That's really good to see that there's even more visibility into this project.
Absolutely. Yeah. GitHub is the place if you have any issues or if you find any bugs.
Bugs? What's that? I know there's no bugs, but...
You know there's bugs. You say you're the largest contributor of bugs. Oh, that's true. Josh has watched. Yeah.
Well, usually those get weeded out. Usually poor Phil. Poor Phil. Poor Phil.
Oh.
I feel bad. I feel bad. The guy.
It's okay. Guy.
Every time I submit a pull request, I'm sure he cries a little bit. Just a little bit. So that's cool. So the Spring Boot Initializer is going to get be given even more love, huh? That's really great. That's one of those, you know, obviously it's now one of our most used products, so to speak. It's one of our most used things with what is it now? More than a million unique projects generated every month from that thing.
Yeah, so that's the other thing. Like, it's hard to actually say what the stats are and what people are using the downloaded projects for, etc. So we do want to get some, I don't know, we want to
metrics,
get actual statistics using more sophisticated tools rather than just, oh, hey, we downloaded a million.
Yeah. I mean, I know that project has been through, I think it was sort of, I mean, my memory could be wrong, but I kind of remember it being this groovy, it was like a Spring Boot, Spring Boot CLI project in Groovy, and then it became an actual Groovy project.
I think it was written in Groovy, and then there was like some Groovy to Java.
That was Dr. Sire. I remember he sent a pull request that just moved it over to Java in one pull request. And
I think so. Yeah, I think that was the history. I've only seen it since it was Java.
Yeah, well, but I mean, it's you know, Stefan, I know, has worked on it a ton and basically, you know, owned it for the last couple of years at least. And that project has been...
Yeah, he's...
Poor Stefan, you know, like... It's so in demand. It's so central. So important to the to all of what we're doing, and so I'm glad you're helping. My goodness, things can only it can only get better, right?
Yeah, that's the hope.
Wow, that's cool. So what will that be? What is the rough timeline on that? Is that like early 2019? We might be able to see rough drafts or something like that. I mean, that's really exciting for us.
We don't have any rough drafts or anything right now. It's mostly just because the team is just about to start working on it. It's first deciding in which direction we want to go, how we want to prioritize things, like what do we want to tackle first. So the first thing that I've already started working on it is I'm moving the CI for Initializer to
Focus. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's on Jenkins at the moment, and I don't think it even runs CI for pull requests.
Oh, wow.
And the release is done from Bamboo.
Oh.
So it's in a whole bunch of places. So I want to bring it into one place, and we moved our Spring Boot build and release process to Concourse.
How'd that go?
So. That went well, actually. So we ended up writing our own Concourse resource. Concourse makes it really easy to plug in things if they don't already exist with this thing called resources. Right. So because it's all external resources, you can write your own resource. And the great thing about resources is you can write them in any language. So guess what?
Is a resource just basically a container?
The resource is...
And for that matter, can you explain to the audience what Concourse is? Sometimes I forget about the insider baseball here.
Yeah, so Concourse is this is a CI tool, and it's sponsored by Pivotal. It's, I think, one of the main distinguishing factors between Concourse and other CI tools is that pipelines is a first-class concept in Concourse. So you can actually construct a very nice input-output pipeline for your builds. So for Spring Boot, we have a build where as soon as we push a commit, that triggers our build. It runs all the tests. And once the tests are green, we publish our snapshots to Artifactory.
All automatically.
So, yeah, automatically. So that's the resource thing that I was talking about. Because Concourse doesn't, like, the pipeline doesn't really maintain state. Mm-hmm. Every build, you can only pass things from one part of the pipeline to another part via resources. So let's say you want to build and then you want to do something with the created artifact. That artifact would have to go in an external resource like S3 or Git.
I see.
Or Artifactory.
So how do you add a custom resource? What does that look like from the perspective of Concourse?
So we just we implemented Concourse's resource API, which is that they have three things. It's the check, there's an in and an out, and Concourse basically calls these three scripts for the resource: the check, in, and out. So check is to see if there's a new version for that resource. In would be it would actually fetch that. So let's say you're pushing things to Git, mm-hmm. right, and you've configured the resource as Git, and you point to your repository, it'll keep checking for latest SHAs to see if it needs to kick off the build.
I see.
So that's the check part. And then in is it'll actually fetch that resource. So it'll fetch the SHA.
Interesting.
And then out is you can actually commit to that Git resource.
Okay. So you communicate through these well-known lifecycle hooks. And there's a uniform interface for calling them from the perspective of Concourse, and what they do behind the scenes is just whatever you want, right? They can do anything basically.
Yeah, they can do whatever you want. So in our Artifactory, we publish our snapshots as part of the Artifactory put lifecycle phase.
Nice. And you wrote those in Spring Boot, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? Of course.
Yep.
Awesome.
And the nice thing is, even if you are an app developer, you can actually, and you want to use Concourse for your application, mm-hmm. CI, you can actually consume the Artifactory resource. And let's say your app depends on a library, you can check for new versions of the library in Artifactory and kick off your app CI based on the library updates to make sure things still work.
It can just do that on an interval, right? You can actually have that periodically pull. Interesting.
Yeah, I think Concourse periodically pulls for new versions by default.
Yeah, okay, but it does that through the Artifactory resource, which is you can tell it to constantly check the resource, and then it'll in turn check whatever you want. Is that true? Or
yeah, so the check looks for new versions of whatever you tell it to
that's
look
awesome.
For.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, you know, I got to get more into this Concourse stuff. I've heard all sorts of good things about it. I just haven't really had a chance to play with it, and my knowledge is unfortunately trapped at the Jenkins level. You know, I suppose I just need to unlearn all the horrendous hacks I've learned over the years to make Jenkins do what I want to do. Because, you know, in Jenkins, you have this second class concept for pipelines, right? It's a plugin, basically. I know that the new one, Jenkins.
Yeah, I think the new one does have some pipeline support, but I really like the customization that you get with Concourse. And the coolest thing is not just that. The coolest thing is that if your build fails, because it's all in containers, you can actually step inside your container and see what's gone wrong. So you can actually, they call it fly hijack. So you can hijack the container and see what's going on.
What does
that
mean? Like you just get an SSH prompt, or I don't understand.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Basically. So I don't understand how hijack works internally. You don't really get a prompt or anything. You just say fly hijack and bin sh or something, and then you're inside the container.
Well, that's awesome. That sounds like you have immediate visibility. That's the other thing.
Oh, yeah. We've used it a ton of times.
I'm sure. Because with Jenkins, it's a monolith, right? So everything's kind of baked into Jenkins, and if it doesn't work with Jenkins, then it just doesn't work, period, you know? Whereas with Concourse, you've got this central brain that's running the system, but all the individual components that do all the meaty work, that's just stuff that you can deploy anywhere, right? It's a container, right?
Yeah, And you control the environment your build is running in. You control, because you can create your own Docker image with whatever your dependencies are. So we actually have our own Docker image for our build, which also builds periodically or builds on if we make any changes to the dependencies.
Oh, wow. So you're testing Spring Boot with 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 Spring Boot.
No.
All the way down. I love it. That's cool. No, that is cool. I know that from an operations perspective, I know there are a lot of people who use Cloud Foundry. So people may not know that we deliver Cloud Foundry through Concourse, right? It's an on-ramp for Concourse.
Yeah.
And so people,
you should see the Cloud Foundry pipeline. It's huge.
It's a eye-watering, but it's amazing when it all works. You know, you see there, it's like, wow, that represents input from feeds of code from all around the world, basically. And it just comes together, you know, more often than not, anyway.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And then for people using Cloud Foundry, they don't really worry about this. They just know that they've got a Concourse pipeline. The Concourse pipeline, just as you say, will monitor input and monitor updates and all that stuff, and do the right thing, which is great. That's so people who deploy one of the most complicated distributed systems on the planet don't even know they're deploying one of the most complicated systems on this planet. They just have this evergreen installer like Concourse. That's cool. Yep. So okay, very good. Let me think about this. That was the discussion of Concourse. I guess the next question is, against all the backdrops of all the stuff we've just talked about, all the stuff that you are working on, including security and Spring Boot, of course, you seem to be doing a whole bunch of stuff with Spring Security and Spring Boot and all this really sort of critical stuff for the for these various projects in the Spring ecosystem. I noticed that clearly, even though you're doing all these really, really important things for the Spring ecosystem, you don't have enough to do. So you've also recently been working to find ways to make it easier for others to contribute. I saw this the other day on Twitter. There was a really interesting thread with you and Spring Boot teammate Andy Wilkinson to encourage the contributions from what is it? New developers, I guess.
Yeah. So from first time contributors. So Andy actually started that thread of tweets where he pointed out to our ideal for contribution issues. So we have a tag or a GitHub label idea of contribution, where if somebody wants to contribute to Spring Boot, they could start by looking at the issues that we've labeled as ideal for contribution. And Andy pointed out to those in his tweet, and he also said that if anybody needs help, he's happy to help. But a lot of times what happens is the ideal for contribution issues, they're not always straightforward, especially for first-time contributors. Looking at the Spring Boot code base itself, if you're new to programming or even Java or just Spring Boot or Spring even, it's not easy if you know what you're doing, unless you know what you're doing. So
chicken and egg.
So we wanted to make it easy so that we can support first-time contributors and not scare them away by giving them these harder or less contained issues to look at. So we wanted to give them issues that are more contained. So let's say documentation issues or simple bug fixes with nice tests that you can write to fix that bug, just to get them started with the Spring Boot code base to get so that they're familiar with how to clone it, how to build it, how to run the tests, and then just get one pull request merge. And then if they want, they can move on to the more complex issues. And one of the things that we really wanted to focus on as part of this effort was to be as friendly, available, and helpful as possible. Because I don't know about you, but when I first started off in open source, I was a bit wary and scared to comment on issues or questions that I wasn't 100% sure of, because it could be a hostile environment, you know, because people, the backlash that people have faced and things we read about in open source can be pretty harsh, and not everybody can take it. So it was a little hard for me initially to overcome that barrier. Yeah. And understand that the Spring community is actually a pretty friendly community, and people are out there to help. So I want to pay that forward by helping other people, especially underrepresented people who might be scared of this kind of backlash, to contribute to Spring and get their feet wet for open source.
That's admirable. The Spring Boot, I think it's fair to say, is maybe just after Spring Framework itself, is already the most widely contributed to Spring project, right? And one of the most widely contributed to Java projects. We've had just a ton of contributions from the community because Spring Boot itself has become so popular. But there's always...
Oh, yeah. The number of contributors is amazing. We recently did a talk where we pulled all the names of the contributors, and they just went on for pages together on
right,
the slide.
Which is awesome. And that's and it's also one of the most, not that this matters even in the slightest, but it's one of the most starred projects, right? Very, very loved on GitHub. So with all that, with all that said, we can always and we always strive to do better, right? We want more contributions, and you're right. There's a lot of, as we know in this industry, it's kind of toxic to first-time contributors, and it's certainly toxic to underrepresented minorities and groups of people that would otherwise contribute if they felt welcome, So we're trying to make that better, and it's good to see that work. I mean, that's super important, and who knows what'll come next,
Yeah, and I don't think it's just I don't think it's just the Spring Boot team's responsibility.
Of course not.
Yeah. So even if you, what I mean to say is, if you've been a longtime contributor to Spring Boot and you actually find a bug which is easy to fix, you can actually say, "Hey, this is good for first-time contributors."
Oh.
Instead of maybe fixing that one yourself, you could tag it. You could add the description such that a first-time contributor could pick it up easily.
Right. That's a great point.
So you can contribute to help people make contributions.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, scale it out. And that's actually great too, because, it's always a kind of a drag to have to report a bug. But knowing that it might make the difference between finding another contributor or not, that's really promising. I mean, there's always a silver lining. That's good. That is good.
Yeah. I'm hopeful.
Well, that's great. I mean, I wish we could talk. I wish we could... I wish we had a broader megaphone for this kind of stuff, right? It's sort of a chicken and egg problem. The more we do to encourage these contributions, the more people will actually contribute, the more people will want to contribute, and the more they'll do to foster more contributions from others. But it's sort of, we're forever pushing a rock up a hill, so to speak. It's, there's never enough, obviously. I wonder, what we can do to make that better. It sounds like this is one thing that's really interesting. I know there's a lot of, I saw a spreadsheet the other, a month ago or whatever, with a lot of different projects that are in the JVM ecosystem that had ideal for beginner style tags for issues, right?
Oh, I don't think I've seen
Yeah,
that
I tweeted
one.
About it, and I was, it seemed like some of our projects could have been in there or should have been in there. So making sure we're on these lists because people actually care about this. This is actually a thing that people surface as a feature of a technology, right? At the end of the day, some things will do what Spring Boot does, but who's going to be there? Who's going to be more friendly to you when you need support, and who's going to be more friendly when you want to contribute? That could be the
yep.
differentiator, So I think that's a feature in of itself. I did another podcast with Cornelia Davis, who I'm sure is she's also out there fighting the good fight, helping raise awareness around diversity inclusion, diversity and inclusion at Pivotal, and I think a lot of what she talked about resonates here. But it has to connect with day to day things like these issues, and that's it's great to see that extension.
Absolutely.
I guess the next thing is, where do you want to go? Where are you going next? What's the next big thing for you? We mentioned Spring One. That's a month away. What's that look like for you, for example?
Spring One is, it's just a month. It's around the corner. I think 24th of September.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
And it's in D.C. this time.
Yeah, that's a fun city. I think we're going to get there right in time for the hot, humid weather to be hot and humid.
I've never been to D.C., so.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's where the history is. My goodness, there's a lot of breathtaking things that you have to go see.
I am looking forward to it. But the talk that I'm doing a joint talk with Andy Wilkinson on the Spring Boot actuators. So Spring Boot 2 actuators. A lot of the actuator infrastructure changed in Spring Boot 2. So I think almost all of it was rewritten.
Yeah.
And we've made it really easy to add your own actuators with just a few operations. So like a read operation, a write operation, a delete operation, which basically maps to, let's say on HTTP, it can be an HTTP get, put, or delete.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to write technology specific actuators if you don't need.
Oh, no, like JMX versus MVC versus.
Yeah, you can just write an endpoint and annotate it with the endpoint annotation, and that'll get exposed on both on HTTP and JMX.
Oh wow! What does that mean for actuators that for example used to serve up images, that kind of thing?
So we have these web specific actuators. So let's say you only want it over the web, you can add a web endpoint. And make it only web-specific. Or if you want it to be a web-specific extension to an existing endpoint, you can add a web endpoint extension and change the behavior over the web.
Wow. So your talk, you hope to chronicle all this great new stuff in Spring Boot 2.0, right? That's 2.0 plus, I guess.
Yeah, and I think we'll also talk about the Cloud Foundry actuator integration.
Oh, yeah. So is that now already working with 2.0?
It is. And I believe it's also working with Webflux. So if you have Webflux or Reactive application, actuators should just work out of the box. Same for Jersey. So
do you work with Jersey? The Jersey JaxRS implementation, Spring MVC, Spring Webflux. Do you work with Ben Hale often on the build pack side?
I work with Ben Hill whenever there's an issue with the Apps Manager integration in actuators. Yep.
Wow. I mean, it's really, I'm sure you remember there was a time when Cloud Foundry was Cloud Foundry, Spring was Spring, and they worked together about as well as Cloud Foundry and Ruby or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But now there's all these teams focused on making the synthesis of all these things much more valuable than each of these things taken apart, individually.
Yep. There's a lot being done there. I think Ben's leading the effort with the Spring and Cloud Foundry.
Well, I mean, he's doing the build pack, and that's, you know, he's certainly doing a lot, but it sounds like you're doing a ton as well. That's I guess what I'm trying to say is this is far more than the sum of the parts, you know. It's amazing to see all this coming together. And hopefully, you know, no offense to you, my friend, but hopefully nobody even notices it. Hopefully it's just so obviously a feature that should have been there.
That's the point. I think the actuator integration is supposed to be seamless. You're not even supposed to have to log in again or anything. It's just supposed to go through the UAA and you're supposed to see your application's dashboard with actuators integrated right there.
Right. And that even works if your app's been secured, right? You can actually lock down your Spring Boot app and Cloud Foundry still knows what to do for those endpoints.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it's a different, for Cloud Foundry, we expose the endpoints at a different path. And that path is authenticated by OAuth tokens from the UAA. So even if you have Spring Security configuration for the rest of your actuators, we have a separate entry for the Cloud Foundry actuators.
And those get automatically registered in the Spring Boot app through the build pack. Is that true?
Not through the build pack. We register them in Spring Boot as part of
Based on the
recap. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. See, that's just super smart. You know, like that, again, that doesn't work unless you have all these different teams talking to each other. Magic, you know, amazing. It really is. I mean, people don't appreciate this until they try it with something else. It's like, oh, I have to do that myself, huh? I'm a big fan. Are you involved at all in some of the PKS stuff? I mean, we're trying to make that more and more approachable for developers.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid I'm not involved as much in the PKS stuff. I just heard about some of the requirements around the info and the health endpoint for the liveliness and the readiness probe. So nice. We did actually, like I mentioned before, we'd in 2.0, we'd secured everything, including the actuators. But for Kubernetes and PKS, because we don't want these basic auth credentials to be sent to the info and the health endpoint, we've actually opened up info and health because they can be used as the liveliness and readiness probes.
I see. Okay. So it's open by default now.
Open by default, and health doesn't show you any details by default unless you flip a flag. So it's not giving you any detail information. It just tells you whether it's up or down.
The management health show details or, you know, that flag, something like that, right?
Yeah.
Health endpoint, yeah. I use that one in my demos a lot because, guess what? I want to show my details. it's a great endpoint. Well, that's amazing. Okay, really cool. I mean, I appreciate your time today, my friend. I know you're busy and I caught you right in the middle of the afternoon, so that's kind of sucks. I mean, I hate to pull you out of the zone and then drop you back into it with very little time to spare for the day.
Oh, it's fine. This was fun.
Thank you so much for your time. Where do people, first of all, I know that they can find you at Spring One Platform this September, but where else would you have people look for you if they wanted to connect or say hi or follow you on Twitter or whatever? What's the, do you have?
Yeah, such so a thing? I think like most Spring people, I am on Twitter. I actually joined Twitter when I joined the Spring team because it felt like the right thing to do. Felt like it was a part of my job to be on Twitter.
I know you're probably monitor Gitter and Stack Overflow, and you know our team is pretty good about being accessible.
Yeah, totally. On Twitter, I'm Madhura Bhave 23. I know it's a long username, but since I joined so late, I didn't get my name.
Can you spell that out?
So it's @MADHURABHAVE 23.
B-E or V?
B-H-A-V-E.
Okay, there we go. Sweet. Awesome. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Any last words? Anything you want the audience to know?
No.
Nope. All right, my friend. Thank you so much. I'll see you in San Francisco and hopefully before DC. And, you know, have a great day.
You too. See you.
A Bootiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm at josh@joshlong.com by email, or of course at StarbucksMan, StarbucksMan on Twitter, where my direct messages are wide open. If you have any guest ideas, topic suggestions, or just general feedback, please don't hesitate to reach out to me at Bootiful Podcast. So at Bootiful Podcast on Twitter. And if you like the podcast, please rate it accordingly on iTunes, as that really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from a Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.